to break down carbohydrate in order to fuel the muscles. So once all of those systems start to take place and get your heart rate up, get the blood flowing to the muscles and away from the digestive system and bringing your total internal temperature up, that's when people say, okay, I'm warmed up. But it is about a 20-minute lag time to get to that optimal temperature.
So if my stomach hurts because I was running late and I ate right before I left, is that partially that antagonism between my muscles trying to work and my stomach trying to digest at the same time?
Yeah, the blood is being shifted away from your stomach to the place where there's the most stress, which is your muscles that are trying to pedal you to work quickly.
Okay, so I have another really simple question, and Jed Van Sickle, maybe you want to field this one. Why don't I fall over? What in my equilibrium? It's not like walking. Why? How does that work?
Physics.
Okay.
Most of it has to do with the spinning wheels and the forces acting because of the spinning wheels that keep you upright. Take, for example, if you try to just stand still on the bike, which, I mean, in Portland, I'm sure you see lots of people doing that at stoplights, it's hard to do.
Yep.
But once you get those wheels spinning, the physics takes over and you can balance.
So momentum is my friend.
Yeah.
Excellent. And I think I see that in my students when I'm teaching them. I also teach people how to ride bikes. And when I'm seeing them teaching them to ride for the first time, it's just getting them to get over the fear of going fast enough that they can move forward, because it's a lot easier to keep going once the physics of the bike are helping you.
Exactly.
So we talked a little bit about that. So Jed, can you tell me a little bit? I also go for rides on my bike all the time. I think many of us commute by bike or do everyday cycling where we're riding to the store, maybe a 5 or 10 minute ride, or maybe they're commuting downtown to get to work. And then on the weekend, I go out and I do a fitness ride where I am maybe riding for a couple hours straight. What's the difference in those two rides? We already talked about warming up. One, I'm actually probably getting to the point that I'm warmed up. But what else differs between those two rides?
Well, like Stacey was talking about earlier, you know, the stress that you're putting on your body once you start working out makes things start to change in your muscle, right? So the longer you stress it, the more the stronger that stimulus is. So the short ride down to the coffee shop or whatever, there's not a whole lot of stress going on. So, you know, you're not getting really tired. You're feeling great. You start going longer, there's more stress. But with that more stress, there's more stimulus for adaptation and getting stronger and getting fitter.
So what happens, you had mentioned that I'm releasing cortisol and adrenaline and all these things to get me going. What happens as I'm sitting here now and I'm sedentary and I'm not doing anything? What is my body doing with all those chemicals it released?
The opposite. Stacey, you're the...
Dr. Sims, would you like to comment on that?
You want me to answer that one? So as soon as you step off the bike and sit down, your blood starts circulating to the skin and back to the digestive system and the heart and that kind of stuff. So you're losing more of the blood from your muscle, trying to offload the heat that you produce, because heat's a bigger stress to the body than keeping your muscles going. And your
really?
Body's trying to get rid of the cortisol and the epinephrine, and it metabolizes it, so your heart rate starts to slow down, and you might have a bit of the shakes if you didn't eat before you left, but you did, so you probably didn't experience that. And one of the ways to dissipate the cortisol is just having a little bit of protein, because that shuts down all the negative breakdown effects of the cortisol.
And so there's a positive breakdown of the cortisol and a negative breakdown. What's the difference?
So you want a little bit of cortisol during exercise in order to break down carbohydrate and fat to fuel the muscles. But you don't want a lot of cortisol circulating when you're at rest, because it stores fat.
Oh,
so
that...
Yes. We call it the belly fat hormone. And a lot of people might be rushing around to get out the door to commute to work, and they don't eat anything until they get to work. And if you're trying to lose weight, this is kind of a negative way of doing it, because you have elevated cortisol when you wake up. you're stressed out, you're trying to get to work, you're producing more cortisol while you're on the bike. And so you have a higher level of cortisol circulating, and when you sit down at your desk and you're sedentary for the rest of the day, it signals to put on a lot of belly fat.
That is fascinating. So you said, but you mentioned having a little bit of, what if somebody didn't have breakfast and then rode their bike to work or ran to work or whatever it is that's going to raise that? And then they get there and they have, I don't know, a protein bar, something with a lot of protein. Will that help offset that?
It would be better if they had half of that protein bar or a couple of bites of low-fat Greek yogurt before they went out, just to shut down that first thing morning cortisol. And so, you know, taking a couple of bites of something as you're running out the door is going to do far more than trying to offset it when you get to where you are with a little bit of protein.
That's very interesting, and that's super good to know. You also mentioned something else a second ago. You said that the heat in the body is one of the biggest stressors. I think that's kind of how you put it. I would think... I don't know. I think the way I think about it, it's like, well, my muscle's working or my heart rate, isn't that the, or my, like, how hydrated I am, isn't that a stressor?
Well, the biggest threat to the human body is temperature fluctuation, because we have a very, very small range at which we can exist. You go below 37 degrees centigrade and you start getting into a little hypothermia. You go above 41 degrees centigrade and you start getting heat stress or hyperthermia. So you have, what, a 4-degree difference.
Wow.
And when you start exercising, your muscles are producing a lot of heat. And that's a byproduct of breaking down the fuel that's going to support the muscle and muscle contraction. And your body's like, I got to get rid of this. So it takes blood to the surface away from the muscles. So if you're dehydrated, that increases that stress. If you are a little bit sick and a little bit nauseous, blood is going to stay in and around the digestive system because it's stress. So, you know, that compounds stress. But the biggest threat, again, to the human body is this temperature fluctuation.
That's so interesting. So I guess that I was going to, this is a question I kind of had for later, but it kind of leads right in right now. So can you talk a little bit about what's the difference if I go out this morning, actually in Portland, Oregon, it's very nice out. It's 60 degrees almost and super humid. So it's really very warm compared to what it has been. But, you know, a couple weeks ago, it was actually a few days ago, it was 33 degrees out. In the same ride that I did, or if I went on, let's say, an hour-long ride, what's the difference in my performance between a more neutral temperature like 60 or a cold temperature like 33 or a really hot temperature like 100 degrees?
With regards to total body performance?
Total body performance.
Okay, so when you're cold, women experience this more than men, but you have vasoconstriction, especially to the hands and the toes. And
does that mean your body's blood can't get there?
Yeah.
Okay.
It kind of restricts the blood flow to your fingers and your toes. And in some extent, forearms, cheeks, other places where there's a lot of heat dissipation when you're hot. And it's trying to keep that blood in the middle of your body, in your core, we say, to keep you warm for, life for the most part. And you'll have blood going to the muscles, but it's not as much as if it was hot or neutral, so you're more predisposed to injury if you're not warmed up or you're not hydrated when you go out in really cold weather. You're more predisposed to injury. When you're in a neutral environment, a lot of people are like, great, this feels awesome, and they forget to hydrate. And you do need to hydrate even when it is neutral. Your body's more relaxed. When it's about 66 is the optimal temperature, especially for like going on a longer fitness ride. You don't get too cold. You don't get too hot. You can maintain pace if you fuel and hydrate well. But when you get into 76 and above, we call this a little bit of a warm to hot range, and
that's so interesting because that seems like such a low temperature.
Right, but it's allowing your body to offload more of that heat, so it's less stress. like with the wind flow against the skin, more heat gets offloaded, and you don't have a big competition between blood going to the muscles and going to the skin to offload the heat. But when you get into a hotter environment, you have the heat that's against you, and your body can absorb some of that heat, and then you also have the muscles that are producing the heat. So there's a bigger stress to offload heat, and so you lose more blood flow to the muscle and more goes to the skin, so you end up being fatigued a lot faster.
So Judd Van Sickle, have you noticed this in your athletes? That have you noticed this effect that it's harder over 76 degrees for them to perform?
Yeah, definitely, and especially without the temperature adaptation. Every year, because the collegiate season starts, well, the cycling season starts so early in California, it's a little chilly, and then in the middle of April, all of a sudden, there's that warm day, and by warm, I mean mid-70s, and it's amazing watching people fall apart, basically due to heat stress, when it's 75 degrees out. You don't think that's hot. But
it doesn't. It seems like the perfect riding weather to me. I'm still a little bit in shock about that. So you were saying that to watch them fall apart, though, that...
Right.
So what happens then to your athletes if it's not 76, but it's 96?
Well, for starters, generally it doesn't go from 65 to 96 in one day. So they have started to acclimate to the heat somewhat, but it does speed up the overheating process for sure.
So what do you do to help them kind of battle that?
That I know is Stacey's area of expertise.
Well, you can talk about it a little bit first, and then we can hear what Stacey recommends. We'll hear what you're doing, and then we'll hear what Stacey.
I actually, for my athletes, I have a whole cadre of things that I recommend for hot temperature, and most of it actually comes from Dr. Sims. Pre-hydrating, having a pre-race drink that's a slushy, a cold to cool the internal temperature. You know, having ice bags in your jersey to cool you while you're riding, all these things, hydrating, obviously, while you're on the bike, all these little issues, these little details, and it makes a huge difference. And I'm, for myself, when I'm racing and it gets hot, because it gets hot here in the Central Valley,
yes,
it'll be 105, and all those little things, and I feel fine at the end of a race, and there's nobody left because they've all dropped out.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing what the little details do. When
How do you have an ice pack that lasts the length of a race?
Either you get one in the feed zone, or
Like
if you're me, you just do shorter races.
Oh, okay, that's what I would do. Especially if it was 105 out. I don't know if I've even ever ridden my bike in 105 degree weather. That sounds really challenging.
That toasty.
And it's something where I'm finding this super fascinating, because I'm someone that always says, you know, I'd rather ride in the cold than in the heat, because the heat seems to get to me faster. And I always thought it was just in my head because other people say, oh, no, I do great in warm weather. And I wonder, or is it possible that I'm an example of someone that just needs more hydration?
I'm going to say, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Illinois. So okay. Cold, very cold winters, very pretty warm summers, very humid.
Yeah.
But I've been in Oregon for 15 years, so.
Okay. So part of it is childhood development. You really start to develop your thermoregulation abilities when you're a kid. So if you're in longer bouts of cold to cool weather, you tend not to be able to handle the heat when you get older. And then the other aspect is, being a woman, you vasodilate first before you sweat. And vasodilation means your pores open up to allow the heat to come out, but there's no water for sweat evaporation. And this is not a really great means of dissipating heat. Sweating is so much more effective. And for women, having a little bit more body fat than men or super lean friends tends to make us a little bit less able to perform in the heat. But then, you know, you can counteract it by doing some heat acclimatization. So you know you're going to go someplace that's hot to ride your bike or race or something like that. You can go into a sauna or do some Bikram yoga and expose your body to hot, high temperatures. So that when you get into 90, 96, 100 degrees, it feels like you're in 60. because your body's reset all of its thermoregulation aspects to that higher temperature.
So it's possible to, yeah, kind of, I don't want to say trick your body, but live in a climate that's not that warm and get your body to actually change how it works with, I mean, how many hours do you have to sit in the sauna?
Oh, it's a 7-day protocol. You go in after your ride and sit in there for 10 to 30 minutes without drinking, and then slowly rehydrating. And it's a big enough stress that your body really quickly adapts to that hot, hot temperature. And this is something that I use with my athletes, and I think Judd might implement it in some of his now, too. And it really acclimatizes people from, like, not the Central Valley, but here in the San Francisco area, or from the Portland area, who has to go to the Midwest or to Texas to race. And they go from, you know, ambient temperature of 70 to racing in 100, and they don't suffer because they've acclimatized to that kind of high temperature.
That is, so if I acclimatize myself, will that hurt my riding in cooler weather?
No, you'll actually do a lot better, because the whole idea behind the acclimatization is to increase the total amount of blood that you have circulating. If you have more blood circulating, then you have less of that competition between the muscles and the skin that causes fatigue and the inability to dissipate heat.
That is, I'm like, now I want to go sit in the sauna and make myself faster.
Yeah, I want my husband to build me one.
There you go. I need it, but I need it. It's important.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've kind of touched on this a little bit already, but Judd Van Sickle, I would love if you would talk to me a little bit more about how my body differs, or kind of in commuting, we said I warm up, and then I cool down very quickly. And food and water are going to help with that, how I warm up and cool down. But what happens to my body in the first 20 minutes, if I was on a fitness ride, I'm going to warm up. And then what happens next? If I'm out for, let's say, 2 hours and I'm not doing intervals or anything, I'm just riding my bike.
That's what you're doing. You're expending energy. You're moving the bike forward. You're warmed up, so everything's functioning properly. And if you've been paying attention to the last 10 minutes, you're making sure you're thermoregulating so your temperature doesn't continue.
I love that word, thermoregulating. So how do I thermoregulate when I'm on the bike?
Hydrating.
Okay. That's the main thermoregulation, is basically, do I want to be drinking water?
I think you probably want to be drinking Osmo.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
And what is Osmo?
Well, I'll push aside a product push and say that water doesn't hydrate, because there is no true water in the body. Everyone talks about body water, but water in the body is a solution of glucose and electrolytes. Not a high concentration. Just, there's a very small amount of sugar and salt in all your body fluids.
Which is why an IV isn't just water. If somebody's dehydrated, they don't give them an IV of water. They give them...
Right. A saline solution. And if they're really, really dehydrated, there'll be a little bit of a glucose molecule in there, too. So what you're drinking, you want to have a little bit of glucose and salt in it, too. And you want to think about what in my bottle is actually going to hydrate me versus is what in my bottle going to give me calories. Because if what's in your bottle is giving you calories, then you're not hydrating.
Okay. Can you talk about that? Somebody's got a kid in the background that's having a hard time right now. It's okay. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that? Why it seems like, wait, you said we need calories to go. Why don't I want calories in my water?
If you put calories in your water, you know, like the typical sports drink or the hammer drinks, those kinds of things, it would be like you're drinking a milkshake on a hot summer's day. It might feel good, but you're really not pulling in any fluid, because it's too much for your stomach and your intestines to handle.
So that same thing which you talked about, like me not or having a big meal right before I got on my bike to commute, if my stomach hurts, it's because it can't balance pulling that blood to my muscles and my stomach at the same time.
Right.
And
the compounding factor is if you're drinking your calories, then it gets into your stomach and your body's like, whoa, this is a lot of stuff. I need to actually dilute it first before I can pass it on. So it pulls water from your blood to dilute it in order for it to go to the small intestines. And then when it goes to the small intestines, it exerts a greater pressure, which signals more body water to come into the intestines to dampen down that pressure. So by drinking something that you're thinking is hydrating you, it's actually dehydrating you.
Because it has too many calories in it.
Yep, too much sugar and too much stuff.
It sounds like it's a pretty delicate balance. But that, in any case, hydration is what kind of regulates your heat and cool. What if, where does food play into that 2 hours I'm on the bike?
If you've eaten within 90 minutes before getting on your bike, then you really don't have to take in any kind of carbohydrate or food until the second hour, because your body's still working off what you had for breakfast. You still have glycogen and fat stores that your muscles can work from, but then you'll start depleting your sugar stores in your muscles and your liver, and you need to add some of that back in order to keep going at the pace you want to go. So about an hour into a two-hour ride, having a bite of a bar or a bite of a sandwich, a couple of Cliff Blocks or something that's easy to chew and digest as your calorie source. And this will help maintain your pace by keeping your blood sugar up to allow your muscles to access the other fuel that it needs.
And then digesting that doesn't pull too much hydration out of your blood?
No. I get this question a lot, like, if I'm eating, doesn't that affect the blood flow and stuff? And you need carbohydrate and protein and fat to all work together because they help each other digest and they work with your stomach enzymes to release a little bit of fuel in small amounts of time so that your system is never overloaded. Whereas if you're drinking a rich carbohydrate drink, that's one kind of macronutrients, just carbohydrate. Even if it is two different types of sugar, it's still one kind of macronutrient, and it kind of sits and is a strong stress to the body. Whereas if you're eating a small amount of carbohydrate, like a block at a time, or you're eating a couple of bites of a bar, it doesn't overload the system, and your body can actually work the way it needs to.
How long did it take to figure that out?
How long have I been doing this? 20 years? No, not quite. A lot of field testing and lab testing to figure out that your body works much better when you're drinking something that recognizes it as fluid to hydrate, and then you're eating something that's not overloading the system.
Do you theorize that might be because our body is used to getting hydration and nutrition separately?
Yeah, more than likely. And you think you can survive 3 days in the desert without water, and you can survive 7 to 20 days without food. So again, hydration becomes a paramount, and it's all about blood circulation.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Well, we are here today with Jed Van Sickle, a bioengineer who is the director of sports performance at University of California, Davis, and head coach of the UC Davis cycling team. And we are also here with Dr. Stacey Sims, who is the chief research officer and co-founder of Osmo Nutrition and an exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist, talking all about how our bodies work on the bike and how the bike affects our bodies in return. This is the KBOO Bike Show, KBOO Portland 90.7, on the web at kboo.fm. Please stay with us for the second half of our show when we return to hear more about how our bodies work or don't on the bicycle and why. Don't touch that dial. Welcome back for the second half of the today's KBOO Bike Show. We're here with Dr. Stacy Sims, exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist, and Judd Van Sickle, director of the Sports Performance Program at the University of California, Davis. Both are here to talk a little bit about how our bodies work on the bike and how we keep going after hours and hours of riding on the bike or not. Dr. Sims, one thing that we had spoken about earlier that I thought was really interesting is why, if I'm the average person getting off the couch, I haven't been riding at all or exercising in any form, will just commuting by bike help me? Will it make me more fit than it would?
Yeah. So if we look at the fitness literature, scientific literature of fitness, if you're doing bouts of 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there, you're going to get lots of cardiovascular fitness. You don't have to think about, oh, in order to get cardiovascular fitness, I need to do an hour of exercise, continuous exercise. And the human body has been designed, just through evolution and everything, not to sit all day and do 1 hour of exercise. Matter of fact, there's more literature coming out showing that athletes who go hard for 1 to 3 hours a day and then sit the rest of the time have worse cardiovascular blood lipids and such than someone who has a relatively a moderately active job, like they're standing around all day or they're walking around all day with no formal exercise. So if you're looking to get health fitness and not race fitness, doing small amounts of commuting a day is perfect. It also helps regulate your appetite. It helps with body composition, losing body fat, maintaining a lower cortisol level, that kind of stuff.
Which we've already talked about the cortisol levels being super important in how you lose or gain weight, which is I'm now going to make sure I always eat before I head out the door. I try to do that, but not always. Although isn't that true? They always are saying breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Yeah.
And now you're actually saying, no, really, it's not an old wives' tale. That's the truth.
Yeah, very true, yeah.
So, Dr. Sims, we talked a little bit about how your body works differently for racing or fitness. We were getting into nutrition. And so can your body, if you keep eating little bits of food and drinking little bits of water, can you keep going indefinitely? Or where's the tipping point? Because I feel like at some point I just get tired.
Yeah, you do. And there's something called central nervous system fatigue. And this is where you have some key amino acids that cross the blood-brain barrier that help prevent the central nervous system fatigue. But, temperature, body temperature, and fueling mechanisms, and some of the breakdown, what we call metabolites from the carbohydrate and fat that your body's using while you're exercising, can kind of inhibit some of that amino acid crossing into the brain. So you'll start to get what we call central nervous system fatigue. And the layperson is saying that is, you just lost your mojo. They're like, I can't do this anymore. I'm out. I'm done. I've got to stop pedaling. Or you're like, oh, I just want to stop pedaling. And that's very viable. It's your brain saying, hey, you got to stop. And then when you get into ultra endurance, you're training yourself through that. You spend a lot of hours trying to train yourself to get through that central nervous system fatigue or, the mental aspect of self-talk of you can do this. This is another way of delaying that fatigue.
Have you found in your studies or your research, have you found scientific evidence that you can think this central nervous system reaction away?
It's not my own research, no. It's in the cognitive psychology and athletic psychology literature, where the mental aspect of someone can have huge implications on performance. And it's the same as going to a gym with or without your iPod. Now, you can last a lot longer when you have music that you really like because it stimulates you and you enjoy it. And there's a positive association, whereas if you go with nothing and you're stuck with classic rock at the gym and that's not your genre, then you're not going to get as much out of your workout. So there's lots of things that mentally people can do to push through fatigue.
So one of the some guests that we had on earlier a couple years ago, Jennifer Cree and Heidi Swift, were two of the six ladies who did the Rev Tour, which was a group of female, somewhat amateur riders competing, not competing, but completing the entire Tour de France over the same daily mileage as the pro riders. So if the pro riders rode 100 miles a day, they rode 100 miles a day. Or if it was 130, they did 130. And we had them on, and they mentioned that they were told by some trainers and people that they didn't think that they were going to be able to do it, because how they were doing it, they said, "Oh, you don't have enough power. You're doing it over this long period of time. It won't be possible." Yet all six women completed it, and it was a huge feat. How is that mental, or what, or did they do something that just has never been studied?
So a lot of that's mental, plus fueling and hydrating well and recovering well between each race is critical too. But when you're out there, and it's kind of like the group mentality, if you start as a group, no one wants to be the person that fails the group. It's just inherent, social aspects of being a human. So if they're starting as a group and they all are supporting each other, then that gives an extra mental edge of, okay, I got to keep going, she's going. And then the other thing is, it was an experience of a lifetime, and they're like, I'm going to finish this. So there's a huge mental component of, I'm going to finish this. So the psychological component was hugely important for finishing that. And then the physiological aspect of planning out the hydration and the fueling and the recovery was critical so that the body could handle the stress and get through those 3 weeks.
Yeah, that leads me to more questions. I want to talk a little bit more about what happens when we get off the bike and recovery. But Judd Van Sickle, I wanted to ask you, do you find on your racing team that there is that, I'm sure there's people who are more of your star riders and not so much your star riders, but I'm assuming if it works like other bike racing that they work together as a team. Do you find that is a huge component of your team's success, is that feeling that we can't let each other down?
Oh, absolutely. We're a pretty well-knit team, but I've seen, because I've been doing this, coaching them for 13, 14 years now, it changes every year, the composition of the riders, and sometimes they get along really well, and they race much better. When they don't get along very well, they don't race as well together. So there's absolutely a huge component of, I don't want to let my team down. I'm going to turn myself inside out to see that we succeed.
Is there any way as a coach you can encourage that more? That do you do team building exercises or things, or does it just a little bit up to fate of how the people on the team mix?
Well, a lot of it is interpersonal relations, but we put a very big emphasis, especially for collegiate cycling, in that it is a team sport. So if you watch bike racing on TV, they get all excited about the first person that comes across the line, and nobody can tell you really who was second, third, fifth, tenth.
Right.
But in collegiate cycling, the goal is for the team to win. So it changes the mindset. We're not all out there for one person. We're all out there for the team. And I think that in itself actually makes it, when you're not getting paid, easier to race as a team and come together, because that's the goal, is for the team to succeed.
That's so interesting. And I'm assuming they're all riding and training together most of the time, or do they train separately and come together for the races?
It's definitely a mixture. The funny thing about cycling as a collegiate sport is, it's not like basketball where you go to basketball practice or something like that, where everybody always goes to the same spot on the same day and does workouts together. They fit it in wherever they can. So they'll go out by themselves in groups of two or three once a week. We get, 50 or 60 of them together.
Whoa.
But
you have a big team.
Yeah, I think we've got over 100 people technically on the team.
Wow, that's amazing. So in any given race, how many people are riding together for the team?
So the cycling is neat because it's broken down into categories. So
right.
unlike other races where, for the most part, if you're doing a running race or a triathlon or something like that, except for the very tippity-top people, you're trying to do the best job you can. In bike racing, you're trying to beat other people. So if we throw everybody in together, that's not going to work out so well. So we have different levels depending on how experienced you are, how strong you are, how much time you have to put in the training. so that you can find a level where you're competitive. And then within each of those levels, we have anywhere between 8 riders down to 3 or 4. And that depends on who's doing better or worse and where the team falls that year.
Okay. So one of the divisions in cycling definitely is the division between men and women. And Dr. Stacy Sims, I know you've done a lot of research. This is one of your focuses of the difference between the physiology of men versus women, which up till now, there hasn't been, it doesn't seem like that's been a very big focus for other researchers. Can you talk a little bit about that research and what you found?
Yeah, so, gosh, if you look at the science literature, most of the women that are involved in the research studies are in what we call the low hormone phase of the menstrual cycle, where women are more like men. And it comes down to ease of designing a study, and if there aren't women involved, then the results of the study are often generalized to women. And early in my career, I was told, well, why do you care about women? We don't know enough about men. I just kind of looked at my supervisor, and I was like, because I'm not a dude. So the problem, I shouldn't say problem, the issue with that is that women have a menstrual cycle, and estrogen and progesterone affect more than just the reproductive aspects of a woman. And this is what makes women, quote, difficult to study. And it is very frustrating to know that someone who does a study on a whole bunch of elite male triathletes and comes up with this 90 grams of carbohydrate per hour is great for everybody, and then a small petite woman tries it and has a total disaster, and they're like, oh, well, you know, the literature says this. No, no, that's not right. So all of my research has been done on sex differences. So if it works 90 grams for an elite 22-year-old college male athlete, sure, but that 90 grams isn't going to work for my petite 5'2", you know, semi-elite woman because of differences in body height, stature, muscle-to-fat composition, estrogen, progesterone fluctuations, all these kinds of things.
So you talked a little bit about the fat affecting how you hydrate in your thermoregulation, but how does the estrogen and the testosterone levels changing affect that as well?
So when it's estrogen and progesterone for women, testosterone is relatively low in women. And that's another story for a different day about testosterone. But estrogen decreases your what we call plasma volume or the water part of your blood by 8%.
Whoa, that's huge.
Yeah, so you're already losing the capacity for blood circulation because of estrogen. Progesterone increases your internal temperature by 0.5 degrees Celsius. So, again, you have a higher core temperature when you're starting. Progesterone also increases total body sodium losses. So women tend to become more hyponatremic or, you know, they suffer more from too much water and not enough salt when they're doing ultra-endurance racing.
And our bodies must do this for a good reason. It must have something to do with reproduction. And that's why it repeatedly does that. But it's not so good for on the bike.
No, it's not so good for performance. The basic idea of estrogen and progesterone is to prepare the woman's body for having a baby. So it's going to increase fat deposit. It's going to put more fluid in and around the cells. It's kind of a holding pattern out of the blood. So everything that it does is preparing the uterus for an egg implantation. It's the side effects that affect performance that women don't like.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And understandably, who would want to suddenly have a great day and a great day and a great day and then feel terrible on the bike for nothing they have control over? So is there a way, as a woman, I can control it?
Yeah, there's various ways, and it depends on if you're naturally cycling or if you're on an oral contraceptive pill or you're using an IUD. But looking at how your body responds, when you get into a high hormone situation, so ideally textbook for 2 week low hormone, then estrogen and progesterone start to go up. We have a high hormone phase for 2 weeks, and then it drops and your period starts. So in the high hormone week, making sure that you're taking in a little bit more salt, you're prehydrating, you're using protein before and after each ride, regardless of if you are racing or training for a race or if you're just out for leisure ride. I'm not saying that every 10 minute commute ride you need protein before and after.
Right.
But it's how your body really pushes down the negative effects of progesterone. So yeah, there are certain things that you can do, and increasing your magnesium intake. Magnesium with zinc will help with any kind of PMS and water bloating. So there are lots of different things that you can do to mitigate the PMS and performance decline.
Has there been studies done outside of cycling on these differences so much?
Yeah, there have been. Running, rowing, and triathlon, cycling. And there are just quite a few small, really well-done studies. It's not a huge field. Again, because it's difficult, they say. But if you take the time and the effort and you understand it, then it's not so difficult.
Right. And yeah, it's so interesting, especially knowing how women in sports is growing, the percentage of women in sports is growing, that someone isn't wanting to fund this more. But that's, you know, I'm sure you know all about that. And it's just fascinating to me. It's half the population, and we're learning to get fit and do all these things, and that it's important. But we don't know how to do that properly because no one's ever studied it, or very few people have ever studied it.
Right. And it extends, again, past sport performance. You look at chemotherapy and other pharmaceutical drugs and stuff, and it's all been done on men, so they're not as effective as women. And it goes throughout lots of the sciences, but our focus is sport performance because we want to be as good as we can be.
Have you done any studying, just out of curiosity, and you don't have to tell me the results of it, but any studying on women in their later life where they're going through another hormonal change of menopause?
Yeah. My last 5 years at Stanford was working with postmenopausal women, and I would use younger athletic controls and do some comparison. And the biggest thing with peri and postmenopausal women is what we call the integrity of the muscle. So you lose neuromuscular aspects, so you want to make sure that you're doing a lot of power and plyometric training to maintain that sprint and capacity and the integrity of the muscle. You also really want to make sure that your protein intake is high, and if you're doing carbohydrates, having lower glycemic carbohydrates, and maybe not so many because your body becomes super sensitive to carbohydrate intake. So there's dietary tweaks that a peri and postmenopausal woman can do to maintain form and function. As long as she wants to, as she's a master's athlete.
Wow, that's so interesting. So Jed Van Sickle, I want to ask you a little bit. You said that your current main focus at UC Davis is injury prevention. It seems like it's pretty simple and straightforward. Just take care of yourself and you won't get injured, and don't overtrain. But it's not that simple, is it?
No, it is. The problem is we have to redefine what take care of yourself means.
Right. Well, I'm fit. I'm on a bike. Isn't that taking
exactly.
care of myself?
Exactly. And I like to tell people at the outset of when I'm working with somebody who's got a bike injury, it's like, hey, the bike is a fantastic aerobic exercise. It is great. However, it's pretty much terrible for the rest of your body.
What do you mean? No, that can't be.
It's bad posture. It's constrained range of motion. It's a lot like, you know, they talk about sitting in a desk all day. Well, you don't really change your position that much when you get on a bike. So you have a lot of the same issues. Your hip flexors are chronically shortened. And when that happens, you stop using your glutes. You're no longer stabilizing your pelvis. You're no longer stabilizing your leg correctly. And things start to fall apart. And we wonder why, it was fine 10 years ago. I haven't changed anything. And all of a sudden, it hurts. And it's because we lose the ability to function properly when we don't take care of ourselves over the long term.
Now, is this just for like a fitness athlete, or could this also happen to a regular commuter?
This is more for a regular commuter, because where are we commuting to? Our office, where we're going to sit all day and probably have bad posture there. And we're never extending our body. We're never working on proper function, which you absolutely have to do for great well-being. So
how would you go about doing that?
Ride your bike, but incorporate other activities as well. You know, if you want to get super basic, you know, do some pelvic stability work. Do some stuff to strengthen your glutes, your balance, your stability, that sort of thing, because that's what helps you function properly on the bike, and you'll get to work faster, but you'll be less injured. And stretch.
So actually, we talked a little bit earlier about the physics of the bike carrying me forward, and that's what keeps my balance. And that's actually one of the downfalls of the bike, it sounds like, is that I'm not having to use my actual body to balance. So that part kind of fades away, that usefulness.
You're not moving laterally at all. So all those muscles that move you laterally are getting ignored and shutting down. And those are your stabilizers. So now you're not stabilizing properly, and your body cheats until it can't anymore.
So for somebody that's riding regularly, maybe not training at the level of your athletes, but let's say somebody's riding 3 or 4 days a week, as much as they can, definitely like maybe long rides on the weekend, maybe they're racing. How would you recommend that? What basic things could they throw in to help balance that out?
Basic one, I would have an additional activity, hiking, strength training, team sports, whatever, but also just stretching so that you don't need to be a gymnast to ride the bike, but you need sufficient range of motion so that you can work correctly on the bike. You know, if your hamstrings are too tight so that they're locking up when your leg tries to go into its correct amount of extension, that's an issue. So stretching, hamstrings, hip flexors, all that sort of thing, and doing some core strength and stability strength training. It's stuff that you can do, you know, 10 minutes a day in front of the TV, and you're going to feel much better on and off the bike.
And you said that your focus shifted to injury prevention. Were you starting to see a lot more injuries? Is that why?
Well, I've seen, especially in the Sacramento region, the emphasis here from the competitive aspect is much more about that that social aspect. So we don't have as many people that are interested in maybe top performance. So the performance lab was seeing a decrease in the number of people here because they didn't want to come in for performance testing, but they were really coming in because they were injured, because they were having pain on the bike.
And these are normal, average people just going out for rides with their friends and wanting to stay fit.
This is from the person that does 2 miles to work 3 days a week to the person that does double centuries, the whole spectrum.
So everyone was having the same, were you seeing the same problems?
For the most part, it's very similar over and over and over again. And you get to the range of motion and you get to that stabilizing and all of a sudden they function much better. Like I said, both on and off the bike.
So have you seen, when people do these exercises, has it made a huge difference?
It's a huge difference in comfort on the bike and comfort off the bike.
Right.
But yeah, it's very significant.
So one other injury question. Let's say I'm on my bike and something happens and I do fall. And something bad, you know, let's say I fall pretty significantly. I slip, I'm coming down a hill and there's an oil spot on the road and it's wet and I slip and I go down. What happens? What's the first thing that happens in my body?
It gets very excited. The adrenaline starts kicking. Your body, if you happen to, you know, scrape a lot of skin off and are bleeding, your body makes sure that you're not going to lose a lot of blood, but your body really gets excited. It's that whole fight or flight thing. You've crashed, the adrenaline kicks in.
Wait, how does it make sure I don't lose blood?
By the same way it did it when you started exercising, by shunting it somewhere else.
Okay. So it can sense where I'm injured and starts pulling the blood away from that area.
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. And then what happens?
Well, eventually that adrenaline kick's going to wear off and things are really going to start hurting.
So how long does that usually take?
I think it would depend on the individual person, but my experience is in the order of 20 minutes or so.
Okay, so in that first 20 minutes, I'm feeling fine. I've got adrenaline because I feel great. Should I keep going? I feel fine.
I'm going to give that a big, it depends. You know, if you've hit your head hard, probably not, because you know your reflexes are slowed down. You're not going to be able to make a good judgment, and you might do something bad. But a lot of times it gets to a point where, hey, you know, you have to get home.
Right.
So if it's really painful to ride a bike, you better call somebody. If it's not, you're probably not going to do any excess damage by riding the bike home.
Okay, so I fell yesterday, and I hurt myself pretty good, but I'm on this training schedule, and I'm supposed to ride 4 hours tomorrow. I'm pretty banged up. I've definitely got some muscle strains and some bad bruising and scrapes. Should I go on that ride?
You know, same thing as when you're sick. If you're not functioning properly, give yourself a chance to heal. Give yourself a chance to get better, because if you push it when you're in this bad situation, sick, injured, whatever, you might just make it worse. So give yourself a few days to recover. You know, if your muscles are really cramped up for one because you hit the ground hard and you jump on the bike, things aren't working properly. Things are pulling in weird directions. And, you know, you do have a chance to hurt yourself some more.
That doesn't sound good. That's
so, yeah. Don't stress so much if you've been training consistently, like I'm sure you are. Don't stress so much about missing a day or two here. It's better to get better first.
So if you're a commuter, take the bus. And if you're a fitness rider and your big race is coming up, if I had a race in, I don't know, 2 weeks, and this is the height of my training, you're still saying take a day off, recover first,
absolutely,
and then go back and finish up whatever your training schedule is and kind of depend
absolutely
on your body to do the healing, rather than say, oh my gosh, I've got this event coming up and I have to be ready. So
exactly,
I have to go out and do it.
And the key part there is don't try to make up for the workouts you miss.
Oh, that's interesting, because I always want to do that.
Right. If you've missed that four-hour ride,
don't worry about it.
If you missed that four-hour ride, it's gone. Don't worry about it. You're fine.
Just count on kind of all the work that you've already done.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, if people want to learn more about exercise physiology, is there some place that they can go that's a good resource?
There's a lot of good stuff.
Maybe they should just Google
everywhere.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Stacy Sims and Judd Van Sickle, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about how our bodies work on the bike. It's been fascinating, and I really appreciate your time being with us.
Thank you.
Awesome.
I can't wait to get back on the bike and think about what I've learned today, and definitely make sure I eat before I ride. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're broadcast from Portland, Oregon on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by Michelle Poirot, Stephanie Routh, and myself, Tori Bortman. We'll be joined by some new co-hosts soon, so look forward to that. We'd also like to thank our in-studio engineer, Tammy, our web host, Chris Smith, and our editor, Josh Hetrick. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the cycling world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. The time is 12 o'clock. It's time for noon news headlines. And then stay tuned for Jazz Lives with Nick Geffro.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, on Monday, the first day to apply for a medical marijuana license in Oregon, 289 internet applications were received, in spite of the $4,000 fee required. Nearly 200 applications were received within the first hour. The rapid application is probably because dispensaries cannot be within 1,000 feet of each other, nor within 1,000 feet of many schools.
A former district court judge from Walla Walla received a sentence of time served plus 2 more months in jail after child pornographic materials were discovered on his computer. This is far less than the standard 6.5 to 8.5 years in prison. The lighter sentence was made possible by state law that shortens sentences for offenders who are amenable to treatment.
In national news, President Obama's budget includes a proposal to extend the earned income tax credit to cover more young workers who are struggling to live independently from their parents. The proposed extension of benefits to childless workers, including those under 25, is a departure from the usual focus on help for families. Current age restrictions prevent workers younger than 25 from claiming the childless worker benefit.
In Columbus, Ohio, Principal Patricia Price suspended a 10-year-old boy from using his fingers to represent a look-alike firearm. The boy was using his fingers to target another boy during playground games. While other boys have played the same kind of game in the past and not been suspended, the school says there have been a series of escalating warnings against the practice, including 3 letters sent home.
The Supreme Court barred states from executing mentally disabled inmates in 2002, but now the court is challenging Florida's use of prescribed IQ scores for determining disability. The contention is made that the IQ score is no certain indicator of prisoner disability. Florida's process has subsequently been so protracted that it has resulted in prisoners remaining on death row in Florida for an average of 24.9 years.
In international news, the world will have to develop new sources for clean water to accommodate the rapidly growing world population. The crisis is most evident in India, where population is expected to grow by 500 million in the next 40 years. Major sources of new water will have to come from creating adequate treatment infrastructures for converting unsafe water to reliable, clean water.
An American anti-war activist was deported from Egypt yesterday while seeking to travel to the Gaza Strip. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of anti-war group Code Pink, was detained upon arrival in Egypt and maintained that airport police broke her arm during her detention. She planned to join a delegation of activists on a visit to Palestine this week.
The International Narcotics Board, part of the United Nations, is encouraging the U.S. to honor all drug treaties in the U.S. This communication is aimed at U.S. states that have legalized marijuana. The INCB was established in 1960 to foster the control of narcotic drugs worldwide.
An Iranian pop star who goes by Gugush has released a video that focuses on homosexual love and is available through the underground in Iran. Gugush, currently living in exile, was Iran's first diva, but the 1979 revolution halted her singing career until she left the country. Her popularity in Iran is similar to Madonna's popularity in the United States.
This is Diane Erickson
and Patrick Wilson
with the KBOO News at Noon, produced by volunteers in our Southeast studio in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and of course around the world at KBOO.FM. It's time for Jazz Lives. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.